Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, you probably take things like sidewalks and basic infrastructure for granted. Well, some people in the Valley aren't so fortunate. We'll learn about a new effort underway in one Kern County community to make walking safer. Plus, we talk with author Tim Z. Hernandez and his new book, All They Will Call You. The new historical fiction novel is based on the tragic plane crash that took the lives of 32 people in western Fresno County in 1948 and inspired the famous Woody Guthrie song, Deportee. Plus, a journalist from BuzzFeed joins us to talk about a major new report on the man they called El Mano Negra, the Black Hand, an infamous hired hitman with roots in Fresno who killed dozens across the country, including many in Tulare and Kern counties. We begin, though, with a look at the biggest story of today, the June primary. Today's election has California political watchers riveted, not just because of what's on the ballot, but also because of the state's unusual primary system. As Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports, the state is split on whether it's actually working.
It's called the jungle primary for a reason. Republicans are at risk of being shut out of California's races for governor and U.S. Senate on Tuesday, and Democrats could face the same fate in several congressional races seen as crucial to retaking the House. All because voters approved Proposition 14 back in 2010.
They will give power back to the people.
That was then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger taking a victory lap on the steps of the state capitol in Sacramento the day after the measure passed. It created a system similar to what's used in Louisiana, Washington, and Nebraska. Every voter gets the same primary ballot with all the candidates on it. And the top two finishers in each race, regardless of political party, move on to the general election.
The Republican Party and the Democratic Party despise this. Why? Because it takes power away from them and gives it back to the people.
8 years later, they're still ticked off. A New York Times article last week quoted the House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield, as saying, "I hate the top two." And the current California Democratic Party chairman, Eric Bauman, calls it the worst election reform the state has ever adopted.
It was sold to the public that it would moderate our legislature and our congressional delegation. It has not done that. And in point of fact, it has often had the opposite effect.
You know, the evidence is kind of mixed.
Eric McGee with the Public Policy Institute of California has studied the system since its inception. He says voters, especially independents who register here as no party preference, have more choices now. That was one of Proposition 14 supporters' main arguments.
But, you know, there's some other things that they argued that really haven't come to pass. The turnout really isn't higher. We don't see a lot more moderation, just a little bit, and some of it is caused by other things.
Like other ballot measures that loosened term limits for state lawmakers and created a citizens' redistricting commission to squelch gerrymandering. But the system does have fans across the political spectrum. Ellen Zarenberg heads the California Chamber of Commerce, which has used the system to elect more moderate Democrats to the state legislature.
I think we made the right decision at the time, and in hindsight, a number of years later, I still think it's the right decision.
And freshman Congressman Ro Khanna, a Silicon Valley Democrat, credits the top two system for helping him defeat an eight-term incumbent.
I think it's fantastic because it gives independent voters a voice in the process. And my belief is the future of the progressive movement has to be a coalition between Democrats, independents, third-party candidates, and this top two system does that.
Still, there's evidence it's not working as designed. Supporters hope that when, say, two Democrats advance to a general election, Republicans would pick the more moderate one. Instead, according to researcher Eric McGee,
a lot of Republicans, somewhere between a third and a half, just aren't going to vote in that race.
Kim Alexander with the California Voter Foundation points out the state has churned through a lot of other primary systems.
And, you know, what I really wish is that we would just stick with something for a while and let voters get used to it.
Polls suggest voters like the top two system as it enters its fourth election cycle with Tuesday's primaries, even though Alexander says they may still be figuring it out. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. On the outskirts of Kern County's largest city lies the community of Lamont, an unincorporated area 10 miles southeast of Bakersfield, home to over 15,000. This corner of the county is made up of migrant farm workers, small business owners, and immigrant families, majority Hispanic. Despite this community's rich agricultural production of cotton, potatoes, and grapes, many neighborhoods there are without sidewalks. And those that do have them, well, they're in terrible shape. Now, after years of planning, a handful of local nonprofits are working together to make Lamont Street safer and friendlier to its pedestrians. Valley Public Radio's Christina Lopez reports.
On the corner of Panama Road and Elmco Avenue in East Lamont sits a street lined not with lush trees, but orange construction cones.
Looks like they are starting to do some work, marking the areas that will need the sidewalks, and I think also marking those areas that will stay. It's going to look good.
Just imagine it with sidewalks, no more mud. I think it's going to look great.
Earlier last month, construction crews began the first of four phases of the Lamont Pedestrian Improvement Project, an active transportation program funded through Caltrans with the purpose to build sidewalks, crosswalks, and curb ramps to improve walking and biking throughout Lamont. Currently, the project is in its first phase, demolition and removing of old and damaged sidewalks. Jose Morales lives in Lamont and is the president of Comité Progreso de Lamont, a local community organization aimed at improving resources within Lamont. As Jose and I walk together, he shares the significance of this project with me.
Tell me how symbolic it is for this project to begin on this street that you were raised on, where you grew up.
Well, it's real nice to see that I'm going to get to see sidewalks. I'm going to see the kids walking on the side instead of on the streets, because it's real dangerous, a lot safer for them. Their parents are going to feel more comfortable, more confidence that the kids have a sidewalk that they can walk on. That's what matters.
Morales and Gustavo Aguirre have partnered together throughout the duration of the project. Aguirre is the director of organizing with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment.
It's going to impact a lot of people, and also it's very close to a couple of churches. It's going to benefit the students walking to their school. So it's going to have a great benefit to this community.
Kern County Public Works applied for the Caltrans Active Transportation Program grant in 2015. The following year, it was awarded $2.1 million for the Lamont Pedestrian Improvement Project. Lamont's grant application ranked number 12 out of 622 applications received statewide. Local nonprofits, including Building Healthy Communities South Kern, CRPE, and Kern County 5th District Supervisor Leticia Perez and staff, supported the project from its inception. Yolanda Alcantar has seen the genesis of this project as the Public Works Manager of Kern County.
Through the application, where parents expressing reluctance to allow their children to walk to school, due to the lack of sidewalks, and the students are forced to walk in dirt shoulders or in the road. And then if there's been rain, then there's mud, and sometimes they get sent home from school. So it causes, array of problems. And with so many inattentive drivers and close calls, the risk was just too great.
According to project statistics, that risk resulted in 15 pedestrian collisions, including one fatality, from 2010 to 2015.
It's understandable that a lot of them don't want their kids to be walking.
Jim Burford is the construction manager for the County of Kern. He has been involved with the project since last December. The project will span 23 weeks of construction, resulting in 4.4 miles of new sidewalk.
4 miles of sidewalk, imagine walking from downtown Bakersfield all the way to Bakersfield College on a brand new sidewalk, a new ribbon of sidewalk.
What do you think this does for the morale of the community?
Hopefully it makes them more invested in the community so that they support and keep it clean and keep them safe.
Aside from new sidewalks, the community will also receive 2 miles of new curb and gutter, a half acre of new asphalt pavement, and 110 new driveways, affecting 400 residents in Lamont.
Just imagine, you know, seeing kids running on the sidewalks. Right now, they can't.
A third of the project is completed with an expected date of completion, October 20th of this year.
I think this parade is going to be a good kind of a Christmas present for this community.
In Lamont, for Valley Public Radio, I'm Cristina Lopez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. A few weeks ago, we reported on a crisis in the recycling industry. Earlier this year, China announced policy changes that restrict its imports of U.S. recyclables, changes with tremendous implications since a third of U.S. recycling exports have historically gone to China. FM89's Carrie Klein explored those policy changes in May, speaking with local recycling companies and policy experts about what's changed and how to find new markets for all that plastic and paper we can no longer ship overseas.
So what does this crisis reveal about the robustness and the fragility of the recycling industry in California and across the U.S.? I got to ask these questions of Kate O'Neill, a professor of environmental science, policy, and management at UC Berkeley, who's currently writing a book on the global waste trade. So, Kate, let's start with some of the basics of recycling. The U.S. exports about a third of its recycling, and roughly a third of that goes to China. At least it had until earlier this year. What happens to the U.S.'s recyclables once they leave our shores?
So they get shipped overseas. They get exported by brokers, not necessarily the original companies that produce the waste. And when they arrive at their destination, they are sent ideally for recycling, but possibly also for dumping or other forms of cheap disposal like incineration, and that poses a variety of risks for the people who are working on or living around those sites.
And in China in particular, though, you know, especially when it comes to plastics, a lot of that material, at least the recycling that we send over there, has been recycled right into a lot of the other plastics that they end up exporting as other goods.
Yes, there's quite a bit of evidence that it has been recycled. Foreign plastic scrap is for sure better quality than plastic scrap produced in China, and China's own production of plastics has been far lower than what it needs. The qualification is that we really don't know under what conditions a lot of this recycling has happened, whether it's in recycling yards, scrap yards, where it's being reprocessed by workers who are not protected by safety equipment, or recycled in such a way that generates a lot of fumes or environmental damage or waste that will leach into the ground or the water supply. So the answer is mixed. I mean, I think that China is well known to have a very high recycling rate across the board, and so do many developing countries, much more so than we do. So there is that upside. The downside is we're never quite sure exactly how or to what extent that recycling is happening in a country like China, which is not particularly transparent.
And so the U.S. at least, you know, certainly prides itself on trying to recycle as much as it can. Of course, here in California, there's a state law on the books that that says by 2020 we have to recycle 75% of our waste. You know, is that a contradiction if we're collecting all this material here, but then still sending large amounts of it overseas for them to then take care of?
It's a paradox, and it's one that I think we're now being forced to face, as some people have been talking about it for a long time, is that when we talk about zero waste or these percentages of reducing waste, what often people are talking about is avoiding diversion to landfill, which is a very good goal, but that means that there's actually been less consideration of, well, if it doesn't go to landfill, where does it go? And this case of where now we're realizing how much of it gets shipped abroad or to places where we don't know how it's being recycled it's certainly causing people to really think about and confront some of the issues with zero waste or increased diversion rate policies that we're seeing.
And so if we do end up continuing to find other international markets to kind of make up for the deficit left behind by China, accepting a few of our recyclables, would this just be, you know, another example of an industry that is outsourcing itself to other parts of the world with maybe less accountability and less responsibility?
Yes, I think there's a very real danger in that. I mean, there historically always has been. I mean, typically when we think about outsourcing, we think about manufacturing things like clothing, things like electronics that get manufactured overseas under conditions that are often extremely bad and that a lot of NGOs are campaigning against. And I think there has been less attention to what happens at the other end. So these goods are produced in China, they get shipped to us, and then when we throw them out, they get shipped back for recycling and dismantling. And that, again, is a part of this whole loop that we haven't really thought about as part of package of this whole product life cycle. And some of the problems have been solved with transparency measures and programs and monitoring and verification and working with the governments and particularly with the multinational corporations who are producing those clothes, who are designing and selling those clothes. The problem is, of course, here we don't have a Nike or a Gap or some other big brand, an Apple or an HP, to target, and that's been what's been effective, is to say, okay, you multinational, we're going to challenge your reputation, we're going to rally consumers against you if you don't change your practices. There's nothing like that in the waste industry. All of that push comes from a variety of different levels. There's a lot of different targets, and it's unclear that how easy it's going to be collectively to change those practices.
So you've touched upon electronic waste, and certainly there's been lots of reporting and lots of revelations about e-waste. Is the same thing happening here with the recycling industry? Could you just compare and contrast these two industries for us?
Yes and no. Yes, there are a lot of parallels. It is, in many ways, you know, it's the same thing where we take our trash and we distance it. I think that there's some critical differences, one of which is that some of these electronics contain many more dangerous substances than even plastic or certainly than paper. And certainly metals are stripped from cell phones or iPads or other kinds of electronics using acid and other kind of dangerous techniques. So there's definitely, I think, a more direct sense of hazard there. The electronics trade is certainly spread out among more countries. It goes to even poorer jurisdictions in parts of Africa where there are even fewer controls. And so the problem that we're dealing with is definitely more diffuse around the world. The difference on the other side is that these e-waste are produced by the large corporations, by Apple, by HP, by other Dell and others. So those corporations can be directly targeted by action groups, activists, and regulators, so that they, if they change their behavior, then we'll start seeing changes down the line. The other thing is that it's more easy to see product redesign to make electronics safer, to make them last longer. All of these things that have been ignored in the sort of rush to sell people more and more iPhones, iPads, etc. And also potentially to make them safer to repair or refurbish, or easier to repair and refurbish. And if that's the case, then they can be shipped abroad more easily, because if they're just being repaired rather than stripped down or reprocessed in ways that are dangerous, then you're creating a market for these goods in Africa, in Asia, and in other parts of the world. So what's going on with China is actually China's attitude towards scrap and e-waste has been a little similar, in that it has really sought to clean up its act domestically as well by acknowledging that recycling happens, trying to stop imports, I think a lot less successfully than they have with plastic and scrap, and formalizing its informal sector in terms of trying to kick out the informal businesses that might be family-run that are doing this disassembling and cleaning and selling on to create a cleaner, quote-unquote, industry that's more easy to control and certainly appears much better to Chinese people and indeed to the rest of the world.
And some recycling industry stakeholders, of course, would argue that the way that we've set up this industry to export a large portion of this material overseas, that is simply the way that a market works, that this is, it's not actually a waste product. It becomes a commodity because we have too much of it and other countries need it. Is there space for that argument here as well?
Absolutely. I've had some conversations with people recently who are like, you should never use the word waste, which is not something I agree with totally, because some things are bad and should be gotten rid of. But I think that framing is something that can be very helpful when it comes to deciding what we do with these substances, whether they're side streams, byproducts, secondary products. There's a lot of different ways you can think about waste. Again, what I'm trying to do in my book is to really come up with a framing for that way to think about waste that makes sense. There is a market. The market is not a bad thing. In fact, it's actually necessary for recycling systems to be effective. There's got to be someone who's going to buy the scrap. And you can make the case that we don't use that scrap. It's used in manufacturing in other parts of the world. So there really shouldn't be absolute bans and restrictions on the movement of scrap, because banning the export of scrap would be almost as counterproductive, if not more so, than other countries banning its import.
And so this whole conversation is couched in the fact that China has recently been shifting its policies on what kind of recycling it's going to be importing from around the world. And so, you know, what do you foresee happening to recycling, to the recycling industries, to jurisdictions that regulate it, in the U.S. and globally?
So I think, as many people in the industry and in regulatory agencies say, we are looking at a long-term rethink of how we in this country and other parts of the world actually deal with our recycling, to the extent of fundamentally reshaping how consumers themselves, how households themselves deal with their recyclables. So we're seeing at the curb level, we're seeing higher prices, we're seeing changes in what can or cannot be picked up. At the local regulatory level, at the level of the companies that collect and sort those materials close to site, they're really trying to look at how they can build better technology, where they can find the money to build that better technology to clean and sort recyclables. This is going to be quite challenging given how local a lot of these facilities are and whether or not they will need to be scaled up or consolidated. So those are going to be issues that will be quite important. And then at the global level, we'll still be moving towards finding new destinations, towards cleaning up the scrap that does get sent and trying to keep track of the volume of waste that we produce and the volumes that we can actually deal with. Over the even longer term, there's some conversations going on at all levels about how we actually reduce the output of waste and use the resources, the scarce resources we have, more efficiently to try and avoid the problems that have emerged out of China's decision to restrict scrap imports.
And so we're all scrambling right now, but it sounds like there could be some good to come out of this, some positive changes for the long term.
I would hope so. I mean, you know, we often have experiences of these sorts of events that everyone gets everyone all exercised and needing to change, and then after a while everyone forgets and it's business as usual. I don't think this is the case here, just because rubbish and trash is so very present and with us. I mean, we are still generating it in large quantities, and it is showing up at ports, at recycling facilities, and very visibly these places are filling up with piles of plastic and paper scrap, which creates an urgency to really come up with solutions that will work over the longer term fairly quickly. I suspect that the recycling industry itself is, although they don't want what's happening right now, is quite excited about the possibility of having new and better technology, ways of making recycling more effective. I know that they were not very happy with the quality of the materials that were passing through their facilities either.
Something to keep an eye on. Kate O'Neill, thanks so much for speaking with me.
All right, thank you.
That was Valley Public Radio's Carrie Klein speaking with Kate O'Neill, a professor of environmental science, policy, and management at UC Berkeley. She's written two books on waste, the environment, and international relations, and is currently working on a third. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. They called him El Mano Negra, the Black Hand, the Valley native who time and again got away with murder, dozens of them, many right here in Central California. Jose Manuel Martinez is the subject of a major new piece in BuzzFeed, which has looked at many unsolved cold cases around the country and caused authorities to take a new look into Martinez and his crimes as a hired assassin. Jessica Garrison joins us now to talk about her reporting. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
The story of El Mano Negra begins not really all that remarkably in Tulare County. He's an American-born bilingual kid growing up in the Valley in the 1970s. Where does his story start to turn?
So Mr. Martinez was actually born in Fresno, although raised in Tulare County and a little bit in Kern County. And his parents were farm workers, and he grew up, in and around kind of farm labor communities. And when he was about, middle school, his stepdad, who was a farm labor contractor and also, according to federal indictments and the family involved in smuggling heroin, asked him to pick up a package. And he did. And then he learned that it had contained heroin. And so that is how he was drawn into the drug business.
But being a hired assassin is another thing entirely.
How did it progress from
picking up a drug deal to that?
Well, I mean, according to Mr. Martinez, the route there was a family tragedy, which was that his sister was murdered when he was about 16 or 17, and he took it upon himself to avenge that murder. He says he was able to identify the people who committed that murder and that he then killed them and buried their bodies in graves that have never been found. So we have been unable to corroborate that. The murders took place in Riverside. His sister was also murdered in Riverside. Riverside County Police will confirm that they have an open homicide investigation into the death of his sister. But they do not have, and they are aware of the other allegations, but they don't have, they don't have bodies, so they don't have an investigation into that. But from there, I think Mr. Martinez, once he had committed those murders, then he was, according to him, again, was asked to kill somebody who had allegedly raped a friend's sister in Mexico. I want to be clear that we don't have any record of those allegations, but he agreed to do the job, and he killed a guy in the farm town of Lindsay in 1980. He would have been about 18 years old. And from there became, according to him, the kind of the guy that you would go to if you wanted someone killed. And he, again, according to Mr. Martinez, said he, often did those jobs if he felt like the person had also hurt women and children, and that therefore his actions were sort of part of revenge or avenging those wrongs.
Now, according to your investigation, he is maybe linked to crimes in as many as 12 states, but many of these murders took place right here in Central California.
If you just look at the numbers, this would make Mr. Martinez one of the most significant or notable serial killers in California. Did local authorities start to realize that they might have an assassin or a serial killer on the loose? When did they start to get on the radar of Martinez, or vice versa?
I mean, I think that's a really great question. So Mr. Martinez has pled guilty to 9 counts of murder in California. He has claimed responsibility for several additional murders, both in Riverside County and those involving his sister's death and some others in the Valley. He was definitely on the radar of police in both Kern and Tulare. You know, they looked at him for a murder in 2000. They looked at him again for a murder in 2009. I think they looked at him again for another murder in 2009. And his name sort of weaves through a lot of these police reports. So as far back as 1980, if you look at the police reports on a murder that he did then, his name pops up. His name pops up again in 1982, but they never charged him. And I don't think anybody had a clue that they were, you know, that Martinez was responsible for 36 murders, or which is the number that he claims. And I think once he started confessing, I think there were varying degrees of first skepticism and then shock. And, you know, I think if you talk to police about him, what they will say is that he was very, very good. He didn't, you know, at murder. He didn't leave evidence. He didn't leave witnesses. He didn't get scared. And he, as one police officer put it, he just got away with it. And then if you talk to policing experts and say, how is this possible? They will tell you that, in fact, it is possible to get away with murder. If you know, in some ways follow the playbook that he followed, which is he wasn't killing people that had any connection to him. So if you look at the victim's life, you're not necessarily going to see Martinez there. And he wasn't making mistakes or leaving witnesses or evidence.
You also write that local detectives were actually using him as an informant rather than a suspect. Tell me about that. And that sounds astounding.
Local officials arrested him in 2013, and he agreed to help them with some investigations that they were working on having to do with some violent robberies in Tulare County. And I don't know that he was an official informant, but they told Florida police that he was an informant, and Florida police were quite shocked by that. You know, I think what they were doing was trying to keep an eye on him, because I think they felt that they did not have probable cause to arrest him. But perhaps by enlisting him as an informant, they could keep him close.
Was he almost daring authorities to catch him?
I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I don't think he would say that. I mean, I think if you ask him, what he says is the police are stupid.
You also write that there's a sentiment out there in some Valley communities where he committed some of these murders, that if this had taken place in a more influential area, more on the radar, that he might not have gotten away with this for so long. What is the sentiment about him and his crimes in places like Rich Grove and rural Tulare County and Kern County today?
I think there is a perception among some folks in a lot of those communities that they just do not get the kind of protection from police that they would like. That, you know, they will complain that they don't get patrols. They will complain that they don't, you know, the response times are really long. I think there's a sense of like people, particularly in a lot of those towns, I think a lot of people kind of knew that he was a killer and were sort of afraid of him. But it was not something that they necessarily were working with police to try to bring him to justice. I think there was more a sense of, you know, this is what it is.
So you mentioned you've talked to him, you interviewed him for this project. This is a rather interesting individual. He's written his biography twice. He talks openly about these murders. What did you walk away from those conversations feeling?
You know, I mean, I think that it's very hard to imagine anybody committing murder. And I think that you sort of think when you talk to someone that you'll be able to tell that they're capable of murder. And you can't. It's very hard to, have a nice conversation with Mr. Martinez and then imagine him committing murder. It's even hard to do it when he's talking to you about having committed murder. What's striking about talking with Mr. Martinez is everything the police say, that, he's charming, he's funny. It's like talking to anybody else.
So how did he eventually fall? How did he eventually get brought to justice outside of California?
Well, there were two strands that kind of brought him to justice. The first was that he committed a murder in Florida in 2006, and he left behind a cigarette butt with his DNA on it. And, Florida police made a mistake too, which is that they collected that cigarette butt and they put it in a bag, and for some reason, it never got tested. And had it been tested, it almost certainly would have hit, because Mr. Martinez's DNA was in the system because he'd been arrested on drug charges. But for whatever reason, Florida never ran that cigarette butt. And so that was a 2006 murder. Finally, in 2013, that murder was assigned to a cold case unit, and the cold case detectives were like, oh, we never tested the cigarette butt, and they ran it, and it hit. By pure coincidence, around the very same time, Mr. Martinez went to visit his daughter in Alabama. And while he was there, he had an encounter with someone who he felt really grievously offended and insulted his daughter. And so he killed him. And police in Alabama began investigating that murder. And while they didn't initially suspect Martinez, they at some point began to and decided that they wanted to question his granddaughter. And Mr. Martinez adores his granddaughter, and he did not want her questioned. And so although he had left the country and was in Mexico, he decided to come back to Alabama because he couldn't bear the idea of his daughter being questioned. And at that point, he was charged with murder in Alabama, and he began confessing.
So how many murders now do we think are potentially linked to Mr. Martinez at this point?
The number that he has given was, he said he's killed about 36 people. He is currently pled to 9 in California and 1 in Alabama, and he's facing trial for 2 more in Florida. And that leaves, by my count, about 24 murders that have not yet been closed. We, in the course of our reporting, went sort of looking for murders around the country that could fit his MO. We found a couple. We asked him about them, and he said, yep, I did them. And I think authorities are now trying to determine what they think of those admissions.
And you looked at a lot of these cold cases in your report as well that might potentially have a link to Mr. Martinez. What did you find? What kind of cases did you look at, and what did you come up with?
We basically looked at murders of Latino men that were unsolved in rural places. Because sometimes he said he killed people in cities like Seattle, and there are just too many murders in Seattle to try to kind of look through and narrow down. But in some of these rural communities, that type of murder is pretty rare, particularly in the 80s and 90s. So we identified one in Oregon that looked like it was, potentially a drug hit that had never been solved. We looked at another one in Idaho that looked like it was potentially a drug hit that had never been solved. Because, of course, by the way, Mr. Martinez said that he went to rural communities in those states, specifically Salem and Twin Falls, Idaho. And then we, I think beyond that, I don't have any way to determine, whether he did or didn't commit those murders. He says he did. But I think there's a whole lot of investigation that has to go on before police can determine whether they believe that.
Are homicide detectives actively opening up some of these old cases now?
To the best of our knowledge, we do know that a homicide detective from Oregon flew out to Florida and talked to him about a murder there. And I think that there are potentially a couple more in California that they're also looking at.
Very interesting story. Again, you can read it online at BuzzFeed.com. Reporter Jessica Garrison bringing us the story of El Mano Negra, the Black Hand, the hired assassin responsible for over 30 murders, according to his own admissions. Who knows the final toll as these investigations go on and his roots here in the Central Valley. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 5 years ago, Valley Public Radio brought you the story of one man's search for names that it seemed had been forgotten to history. It was all about a plane crash in rural Fresno County back in 1948. The plane, a flight from the U.S. Immigration Service, had 28 passengers, Mexican nationals, on a flight from Oakland to El Centro. All aboard died, but when newspapers came out the next day, those on the flight were given just one name, deportees. The subject of that story was Valley author Tim Z. Hernandez, who now has a new novel out based on this story. It's titled All They Will Call You, and it borrows its name from the lyrics of Woody Guthrie's famous song, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, better known as Deportee, which was also inspired by this tragic crash. Tim Z. Hernandez joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Tim, good to have you back.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's always a pleasure coming back here to Valley Public Radio.
Back in 2013, you told our Rebecca Plevin that you couldn't move forward with this novel until you found these families. I think at that point you had located a few names, but it was early on in the process. Yes. How difficult was that search?
You know, it was extremely difficult. And, you know, what I've learned about this kind of work is that the moment when you actually sort of surrender, when you stop searching and you kind of just give it up to the universe, then the universe has a way of responding and answering back. There's no other way to describe it except to use the word synchronicity. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, I did a lot of the legwork from 2010 to 2013. And I, you know, trying to search and turn over every stone possible and couldn't find any of the families. And it was finally when I released the information to a local newspaper, Vida en el Valle, then all of a sudden I said, you know what, I'm going to put the story out there and let it go. It's not my story. It's the world's story. And as soon as I did that, within a matter of a few weeks, I started to find the first family, and that's how it started to roll.
So what did you find?
I found the Ramirez family, who are here in Fresno. You know, they own the Ole Frijoli Mexican Buffet there on Shaw and Blackstone. And you know, and of course, you know, and again, this synchronicity, this alignment, because the first family, the Ramirez family that I met, you know, it could have been, they could have had any amount of information or no information at all. And yet they actually had the one clue that I would use to continue to search and find the rest of the families. And that is the only surviving Spanish newspaper that was printed here independently in Fresno, called El Faro. And it's the only copy in existence to this day. Now, that I say that now having been to the Hispanic media newspaper archives in the University of Houston and researched everywhere. And that's the only surviving newspaper, and they had it. And that's the paper that printed all the names of every family member, their addresses in Mexico, and their surviving family members back in Mexico. That's how I was able to find them, with that clue.
So where did that take you?
It actually took me from here to the East Coast, talking to Pete Seeger, trying to speak with him about what he might know, and because he was the first man who recorded the song. It took me to the Navajo Nation down in Rough Rock, Arizona, looking for the gentleman who actually took the Woody's lyrics first and turned it into a song. And then it took me down into central Mexico, to Jalisco. It took me to Aguascalientes. It took me down to Zacatecas, all over to Guanajuato. And of course, all over this beautiful Central Valley of ours. So, yeah.
How did the families react when they get this call some 60 years after the fact?
You know, all of the families, I mean, they had different bits of information. So the response was generally they were kind of at different parts in the story or different parts in the maybe closure process. But one thing that happened with all of them is obviously they were moved, emotionally moved. They cried and wept, because it was revisiting a wound that even if they themselves did not know personally their relative who died there, just through the sort of familial memory that was kept, they felt that wound was still open. And so when I, here I am 70 years later at their door talking to them about their relative and that I have information that they didn't know that that was lost once upon, they just wept openly. And then, you know, obviously we're just very grateful for that kind of closure.
So again, this name deportee has been applied to these people in the past. Was that really an accurate word to be used in this case?
No, it's not. It's an abstraction. And, you know, it's like one of those obviously sort of, I guess, necessary evils in the world. We have generalizations. But in this case, you know, the media, the print media at the time could have very easily listed on the names, at least the names of 28. And it was that omission that spurred Woody Guthrie to write the song. So deportees obviously is does no real respect or dignity for who those people were, what they were doing here, and their own stories, their personal lives, you know. Yeah.
And what do we know about them as a whole, as far as their families and, yeah. and sort of the long trail of history, not yet yeah. getting into your novel.
Sure,
but
sure. Now, they come from all different parts of Mexico. Mostly a lot of them are coming from central Mexico because that's where some of the main recruitment stations were for at that time, the guest worker program that was called the Bracero program. And they all had some of them were fathers. Sons, you know, brothers who were lost and no one knew where they were. And all of these, the one thing is they all had family that loved them and that missed them dearly and that their legacy remained on the lips and in the mouths of their communities to this very day.
Now, since you started this project, there have been a lot of changes. A, all the research that you did,
right.
but at a much larger level, the national political climate has also changed.
That's right.
And has in many ways become more hostile to immigrants than when you began
yeah.
this search. In writing this book, how do you navigate that?
You know, I don't know. You know, I mean, in many ways, you say it's more hostile, but I think you know, probably more accurately, it's more openly hostile, right? Because it's always been hostile, and now it's just openly hostile. But, you know, one of the things is recently this year, on January 28th, which was the 70th anniversary of the plane crash, the California State Senate, they actually recognized this incident formally on the Senate floor. Myself, I was present. And so were the family members of the surviving family members of about four of the plane crash victims were there with me carrying their photographs on the Senate floor. And also the musician Joan Baez was there who recorded the song as well. And it was a moving ceremony in which the Senate basically recognized that this was an incident that the government did wrong by omitting the names and should at the very least have mentioned who they were and paid that kind of respect for the work that these people were here doing as part of this guest worker program. So it was really moving. And it obviously, it's in the context of what we're seeing going around today, this, you know, nationwide kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that we see. And, you know, for me and for the families, it was really a kind of a ray of light that there is still hope, not just within our communities, but within our governmental systems. There is still hope of not only recognizing these people, but in the sort of more symbolically recognizing all of those who are still here today doing that same work for us. And what was spoken, the words that were spoken there by the Senate really sort of rung out for us. And we just felt like, you know, if the rest of the country could see this and hear this, this is what's important, you know. But it was a ray of light, I think, for all of us who were present there and obviously given in today's context.
If you just joined us on Valley Public Radio, we're talking with local author Tim Z. Hernandez. His new book is called All They Will Call You, and it borrows its name from the lyrics of Woody Guthrie's famous song, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, better known as Deportee. This transitioned from a historical project to a genealogical project in some regard, now to a literary project. How do you go about, or how did you go about, taking these different threads that you came up with and crafting them into a novel? You've done this before.
With Be Franco and Mañana Means Heaven, which you guys covered as well. Yeah, you know, and this was obviously a very ambitious project. I didn't know which direction it was going to take. And in fact, I thought, you know, I could spend the rest of my life searching for these folks. You know, I don't know. And in the by the time the book was published in 2017, I had actually located the families of five of the Mexican passengers and the pilot and stewardess, so seven of the total 32 passengers. And, you know, I believe that when art, in the same way Woody Guthrie created this song and sent it out into the world, and it's kind of sailed on for six decades, you know, it has gravity. Art has gravity, as we know. And so because of Woody's song, this story survived long enough for me, the son of migrant farm workers, to find it and to research it and to find the families. Now, My belief was that if I put these stories into a book, even not having found all the families, I believe that that power of art, that gravity, will find more families. And indeed, it's exactly what's happened in the last year since the book was released. I have found three more families. Three more families with wonderful stories, compelling stories. And now I'm realizing, and that's because also there's still more information coming in. And I said, oh, Tim, this project isn't over. There's still much more work to be done. So moving forward with that, I think that if there was any real way to kind of weave these stories together, it was to allow the voices of the family members and their memories to be the narrative that pulls us through the entire book. And that's what I tried to do most, get myself out of the way as much as possible and let them tell the story.
Do you have a similar problem to makers of not necessarily documentary films, but films based on a historical event? We kind of already know what happens. How do you go about something like that? We think of a plane tragedy as a terrible ending, which it truly is. But right. Does that present a unique challenge for a writer in this case?
It does. In fact, it really does. And one of the things I thought was, you know, okay, if we look at this just for the story element, right? If we just look at it on the page as a story, I thought, well, the plot is already blown. We know how it ends. They all die in a plane crash. So I thought, well, then I need to just be upfront with that right at the beginning. Let the reader know what we all know. We all know they die in a plane crash. So I give the reader the plane crash scene, but only from the perspective of the eyewitnesses standing on the ground. So it's still a very, immediate response eyewitness account of the plane crash happening. And then what happens, my job then is, after you see the plane crash in the first 20 pages unfold, then I take you back to about every single passenger that was on, or at least the ones I found who were on that airplane, and I start to tell you their stories as told through their family in a way that, hopefully, my goal is, in a way that makes the reader forget that they are going to die, which is a big challenge. But I said, if I can get them into their love, you know, there's a beautiful relationship between a man and a woman, and they fall in love, and you see their courtship unfolding, and it's true to what they told me, the oral history, and it's such a beautiful story that you do get caught up in that. There's another story of two brothers, who wants to come to the United States to be a baseball player, and you get wrapped into those stories, so that by the time you've got all of their stories and what, all the way up to the moment that they're about to step foot on this airplane, then you're reminded, oh, they're going to die. And now, though, I do a reenactment, which is a documentary film move, right? I sort of create a recreation of what could have possibly happened in that plane. And it's told now, though, from inside the airplane, seeing the perspectives of these characters that you've read about and lived with for a while. Now, when I wrote this scene, obviously it's a leap of imagination, but it's an informed leap, as much as you would find in a documentary film. I actually sat inside of a Douglas DC-3 airplane and wrote that entire scene from inside of the airplane, like from inside an airplane at this museum in Santa Teresa, New Mexico. And, so I try to recreate that as realistic and detailed as possible with what I knew. Yeah.
How has the book been received? You mentioned hearing from new families that you didn't know were out there since it's come out.
It's been incredible. It's been incredible. The book, the families have been obviously very grateful for it, but the families have been one of the biggest champions of the book. And I think that was really important to me. You know, I didn't want the book to come out and for the families to not like it. That'd be, you know, I want them to feel like I did justice to their relatives. And even, you know, I think it's important to clarify that it's not only the families of the Mexican passengers, but also the American crew members' families as well. Frank Atkinson and his wife, Bobby Lillian Atkinson, the stewardess, died in that crash, and I'm close friends with their family now. And, you know, they were the first ones to express their gratitude for how I portrayed Frankie in that. Because the idea here is that, look, there were 32 human lives that perished in that accident. None of them spared the same fate. So if I can just elevate all of their humanity, each one side by side, then we as people can see this story and realize that I think we have much more in common than we do differences, and we're all hurling toward a common fate.
You've been teaching at the University of Texas at El Paso for some time now. You're leaving Fresno. Most of your stories are here, though. Do those stories go with you, or do they always have a grounding, a rooting here in the valley?
They're always rooted here, but, you know, I think of Steinbeck's wonderful quote, which influenced me early on. He said, you know, I want to write about this valley in a way that it is the valley of the world. And that's what I feel like. All of my stories begin and end here at home. But my job also is to travel the world, to go and live in other places, to get these stories out as much as possible, too. And, you know, so that there's always this kind of international and yet local sort of exchange. And that's what I hope to do forever.
Tim, before we go, you have an event that is coming up here in the Valley. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's at the Woodward Park Library branch on this Thursday at 5:30. And it's actually the Chicano Alumni Book Club. And we're going to go there and do a discussion. But we want to make it a public event, invite the community out. A lot of folks who haven't been able to engage with the book and have this conversation. And basically, it's going to be my last reading here in Fresno before I head back to El Paso. So I'm looking forward to just everyone coming out and enjoying it.
We've been talking with author Tim Z. Hernandez. The Fresno novelist has a new book. It's called All They Will Call You. It's a new telling, historical fiction based on the tragedy that took place in western Fresno County in 1948, where a plane carrying 28 Mexican nationals crashed out of the sky. All those aboard, including the crew, were killed. It also inspired a famous Woody Guthrie song, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos. Tim has done not only great work in this novel, but great work in tracking down many of the families that are still out there of the victims of that crash. Tim, thank you so much and best wishes as you uproot and move to Texas.
That's okay. You won't get rid of me for too long. So thank you so much. I appreciate you guys here. Thank you.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, visit our website, find our comments page, and also subscribe to our podcast at kvpr.org. For Valley Public Radio, reporters Christina Lopez, Laura Tsutsui, Carrie Klein, and Monica Velez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.